Greetings. I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. For all the returning listeners and subscribers, thank you for coming back. For those new to the channel, welcome. Hope you enjoy the show. If you do enjoy the show, make sure you hit that like and subscribe on the way out. Getting that out of the way, let me bring in my co-host, my homie, my dog. He is the man of the hour, king of Miami, the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles. Nice hostages you're banging out there.
This is from the AI music that we are provided from the system that we use. So maybe house music is something that this AI does right. I see Dr. Claus said, turns up to Bitter Lake. I'm going to be putting out some Bitter Lake music that hasn't been on Spotify soon. So keep your eye out for that. All that stuff dropped a few years ago. So the ADOS song that is the end credits for the original cartoons outro. All that good stuff is coming out on Spotify soon. So Fanon can't save us now. Dun dun dun. Frantz Fanon, for many people, is the face of decolonial studies. His books, Black Skin, White Mask, and Wretched of the Earth, are extremely important texts. But what do so many people do wrong when they read Fanon? A book was published a few years ago of some unpublished Fanon essays, and our guest today wrote a review in the LA Review of Books on it titled Fanon Can't Save Us Now. Here's an excerpt from that review. Fanon has become an almost mythical figure in anti-racist and anti-colonial discourse, and in the process, many of his specific political commitments have been watered down or edited out. Any reader of the vast literature on Fanon might be struck, for example, by the relative neglect of Chapter 3 of Wretched of the Earth, The Misadventures of National Consciousness, in which Fanon raises alarms about the rise of a post-colonial national bourgeoisie. We have seen how the colonized always dream of taking the colonist's place, not of becoming a colonist, but of replacing him. Fanon wrote at the start of Wretched of the Earth for the bourgeoisie. He goes on to say, nationalization signifies very precisely the transfer into indigenous hands of privileges inherited from the colonial period. Fanon's relentless attack on elites offers a prescient counter to the scores of corporations today affirming their commitment to black liberation, a vision that has reached its apotheosis with Goldman Sachs' $10 billion investment in redressing the exclusion of black women from capital accumulation. That is a quote from our guest today, Todd Cronin, professor of art history at Emory University. Please give a warm TIR welcome to Professor Todd Cronin.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming on, Professor Cronin.
I love the podcast, so...
Thank you very much. We do our best to do this show, and this is one of those topics where I'm sure a lot of people are going to be pissed off. Like, I'm not even looking at the comments. I'm going to look at them right now. Pascal's eyes. I just saw Pascal's eyes veer off. It's like, don't do it. As you rightly state in your review, Todd, Fanon is used in anti-racist and anti-colonial studies and Afro-pessimism. What are folks missing when they are using the writings of Fanon for these subjects?
In your opinion? I mean, Fanon's like a kind of industry, it seems. And so when you guys mentioned, you know, maybe I'd come and talk about Fanon, that was right after this brand new book dropped, right? So this... Mm-hmm. It's big. Schatz's biography, The Rebels Clinic, on Fanon. It's been many years in the making, and Schatz it's a serious biography, you know. There's a lot of archival research, and it's a very good read and all that stuff. But you know, it is a fundamentally kind of bourgeois biography of Fanon. I mean, it just continues the process of editing and neutering and neutralizing and just sucking the life out of Fanon, and turning him into a kind of cultural artifact. I mean, that's not exactly the intent of what they're doing. They're trying to bring attention to him, but in the process, they just drain it of its, what I want to call as politics, which is Marxist. And, you know, I think that's actually pretty straightforward in Fanon. There's a lot of discussion about how Marxism's, you know, the nature of Marxism in Fanon, but it's actually really pretty straightforward. And that is, you know, there's basically three aspects of Fanon that's Marxist, and all three of them get kind of drained out of it. Mm-hmm. The first one is, and that's the kind of, you know, Fanon can't save you now part of it, is that he's a strategic, tactical, contextual thinker. He's like, you know, in the trenches for a lot of his writings, right? So after 1954 and the Algerian War starts heating up, he's radicalized very quickly. And his writing is deeply kind of connected to the struggle. And he's not writing theory, right? He's not writing a theory that can be extracted from the context of which he's writing. So that's the first thing is, you know, I think he thinks of himself in the Lenin tradition of a kind of practical writing. So he calls it pragmatic realism. Mm. That's one thing that's, you know, is left out when they try and make him a theorist. And the theory of Fanon is really based on the first book, Black Skin, White Masks, which is a very great book, but I don't even think that's a theory, you know, a theoretical or philosophical text in the way that people make it out to be. But the second thing that's Marxist about it is the key to the castle in Fanon is understanding how history works for him. And that is Marxist in the sense that I'll put it as kind of basically as I can, but like in the Communist Manifesto, the characterization of bourgeoisie as a kind of necessary step in the process of towards communism. That's exactly where colonization stands. So colonization is the kind of bourgeois, in a sense, necessity that needs to be violently overthrown to get to the new place. Mm-hmm. So the colonists bring certain things, and part of it is, you know, people don't like this part of it, but Fanon is a secular thinker. He's a secular, you know, he thinks that the new African, you know, national consciousness national consciousness, he says, is completely opposed to nationalism, right? So national consciousness is thinking of Africa as its own kind of entity with its own needs, and those needs are not going to be the past. So he's okay with the kind of erasure of certain kind of bad, he thinks dead traditions, mostly superstition. So he's withering about superstition and religion. And that got him into trouble in the revolution. And this is a kind of complicated point about it. But for him, he always thinks of history as a kind of like, as a transition between one state and another. So like, for instance, a super famous discussion on violence, maybe over famous discussion about violence. Mm-hmm. It's an account of like four violence. He's just saying, this is the situation we're in right now. Mm-hmm. Violence is the step that needs to be taken in this particular context in order to get to where we want to go. And then he talks a lot about where we got it, when we go from after that, what that's going to look like. And that's when he has this massive kind of assault on what we would call the PMC, professional managerial class. And he calls it the managerial class. This is the African managerial class. It's like a low gray bourgeoisie. That's where he spends, you know, a lot of retro there talking about this class that's coming in to kind of pick up the scraps, opportunists, feeding on the cadaver of colonialism to get their share. And in the process, they are, you know, they are destroying the revolution. And that is a great deal of what Fanon talks about. And that part of his argument is really not at the core of his reception. Let me just put it bluntly. Mm-hmm. His concern about how this cultural elite, the colonized intellectual, as he calls it, comes in to pick up the scraps, which is, again, this kind of amazing account of opportunism that is the kind of destructive force. But the other way in which he is Marxist, and this is maybe even the most fundamental of all, is that he thinks class is what drives something like race. So he puts it absolutely bluntly in all of his books from beginning to end, that class comes first, exploitation comes first, and racism is the way in which exploitation it functions. That's why you need racism, or racism is a tool by which a capitalist exploits people. It divides people. And that's, you know, that's the fundamental Marxist premise. And that is, that part of it is systematically repressed. Yeah, we can get into why. I mean, it's kind of interesting why Fanon, of all people, is the target of this kind of, you know, editorializing.
Pascal, do you want to add?
Yeah, I want to ask you this. Fanon rooted his solutions for colonized Africa on solid political economy, as you state in your piece. Why do you think that Fanon has been appropriated by these other thinkers so much when even his solutions are rooted in political economy?
Yeah, I mean, that's the untold story. It's totally true. He's a romantic figure. He has an attractive life. He's an attractive person. You know, so he's born in 1925 in Martinique, Caribbean. Fights in World War II on the side of the French against the Nazis. Becomes disillusioned because of the racism in France. Goes back to Martinique. Comes back to France. Works in these psychiatric hospitals and is very, very instrumental in creating new techniques for dealing with psychopathologies. And then he goes to Algeria, and he's right in the thick of things with the Algerian War. He is then exiled to Tunisia, to Tunis. And then he spends kind of the rest of his life in Tunisia. And he dies very young in 1961. He actually dies in Maryland, United States, funded by the CIA, strangely, dies of leukemia. So he's a tragic figure. He's a very, very powerful writer. He's a very great writer. And I think that mixture, and he was taken up, you know, famously by Black Power, in various ways, by Black Power, you know, writers in the 60s. And it was called, you know, Wretch of the Earth was called the Bible for many of them. Mm-hmm. But I really think the kind of canonization of the kind of fucked up version of Fanon is with the translation in 68 of Black Skin, White Mask. And there is a chapter from that book called The Fact of Blackness, which is the actual title, which has been, you know, retranslated correctly, is The Lived Experience of Blackness. But The Fact of Blackness was anthologized everywhere, right? So that's the kind of portable version. So people basically had two chapters. They had like The Fact of Blackness, and then they had the On Violence. Mm-hmm. And it was just a kind of, you know, those are really, you know, again, they can become kind of theoretical. They can be totally taken out of the context of what he's writing and become a kind of, an independent statement or something on race.
Then, and I pose this question to the both of you, Pascal and Todd. Then does Fanon, in a way, end up kind of like King, where King is forever immortalized in 1964, stripped of his real politics, and all we know about him is like the tail end of a speech and maybe images of the marches, right? Images of him getting arrested. Is Fanon kind of in that same way where we're, like you said, a romantic figure? They both died at 39, if I'm not mistaken, right?
It's 36,
Do we take away from Fanon the chapter on violence, and he's the violent revolution guy, just like King's the peace and love guy. Is that the way that both of these guys are looked at then?
I've always believed that one of the reasons why Fanon was so appealing to the mainstream intellectual chattering class is that he puts a petite bourgeois veneer on revolutionary violence in a way that is acceptable to the aesthetic of middle-class intellectuals.
How is it acceptable in your opinion?
Because it doesn't have the same kind of... It's not the Mau Mau. It's not like, you know, the urban... It's not like the rebellious revolution from the bottom. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you know, oh, you know, it's the intellectual posturings of, you know, a doctor, a psychiatrist, you know, oh, this is fascinating how he can talk about, you know, the violence of the revolution, as opposed to confronting the actual violence of the actual rank and file peasantry in the actual, you know, thoroughfares of the colony. So, I'm a fan of his work. I always have been, but I've always been suspicious of the way he's been so easily appropriated by Western intellectuals. I'd like to hear your thoughts on that, Todd.
Yeah, we were chatting about this before. It's like, well, what is it that's actually going on when there is this kind of need to transform all of the radical politics into something that's consumable, right? To kind of edit it out in a way that you know, gets rid of the poison. And, you know, in you know, my world, we call it presentism, right? Kind of just like taking your present concerns and just like throwing it onto the past and shaping it to your contemporary needs. And if you do violence to it, then you do. But we were talking about, like, you know, these recent things, like, you know, the Rustin film, which is this kind of similar in a certain way, in that, you know, you have to do a certain amount of work to take someone like Rustin and make him into this kind of, you know, identity politics hero, and just make it pure romance, right? And drain it of the least, you know, the most basic aspects of his thought. One of the things about that Rustin film is, if I remember right, I don't think the word labor is uttered like once in that film. It's fucking 90 minutes, you know? But I mean, I think the Fanon is similar. But yeah, I think you're right though, Pascal, that the violence, the part about the violence is lends itself to a kind of romance that, again, I just don't think that Fanon quite saw coming, but maybe he should have. I mean, he was 36 when he died. It's, you know, it's not an all cogent account that he has. And it's important to kind of demythologize him, because I think he's a very, very interesting and important figure, and a kind of crucial thinker. But the mythologizing and romanticizing, which I guess he did lend himself to in a certain way, partly because he's writing in this rhetorical way that's meant to kind of get people, you know, drum up excitement for the revolution, that it oversteps the mark a bit. I mean, is that his fault? Yes and no. The thing that, you know, that is the concerning part is, why is it there is this kind of like, you know, extreme desire to rewrite the past in our own terms, even the most obviously inappropriate stuff.
But isn't that dangerous, though? Because we it's almost like we're taking out of context the moment that Fanon is in, as you're talking about. You know, it's a very tumultuous moment in the part of Africa is in. Before we even came on, Pascal mentioned that Fanon doesn't even really talk about sub-Saharan Africa.
Right.
He just talks about, you know, a few regions, and definitely doesn't really talk about the United States at all. So are people wrong then to use that kind of decolonial thinking in the U.S. context, for example, because that's still here we are in 2024, and you still hear people talking about the internal colonies of the inner cities, what is his name? Donald Harris called out in the 70s. I think 73, he writes that really great paper that Adolf shared with us. Shout out to Adolf Reed, that we quote so much on this show. But is this kind of where that reading of Fanon goes wrong when we think about like the internal colony theory?
Yeah. So that's a really interesting point, because I mean, one of the things that is, again, all too rarely mentioned about Fanon, and he dies in 61. So he wasn't really around, you know, for when Black Power stuff really got going, but he did say in Wretch of the Earth, this is not for you guys. And because he says, so colonialism involves a military and police, right? Mm-hmm. And that's it. And that's like literally what he says, right? So the idea that a colony is in your mind, or, you know, in my world, you know, fucking insane things like decolonizing your syllabus, that has absolutely nothing to do with, you know, Fanon. And he did say that. I mean, he knew that. He was specific about the things he was interested in. And he says, you know, like at first there seemed to be some commonalities, but then we both realized, meaning both he's talking about New York and Chicago, we both realized that our situations are different. The situation in Africa, the situation in the United States is different. So yeah, if you don't have an army, you don't have a colony. He just says that, right? And he is, one of the things I should just kind of add to that is there's a ton of stuff he writes about the turning of colonialism into a psychological phenomenon. And so he hates the idea that racism is unconscious, right? Mm-hmm. And he's constantly talking about this, that the colonizer wants it to be an unconscious thing. But in fact, the colonization is all about is shoving it in your face all day long, your inferiority. It's not something under the table. It's not an, you know, unconscious bias. It's not microaggressions. It's fucking aggression. Mm-hmm. And it is meant to keep you in place all day long in a thousand different ways. So it's a police state. And you are meant to feel inferior every moment of your life to keep you under wraps. So he thought the kind of psychologizing of it was completely bizarre, or just wrong.
Pascal?
Well, then again, that gets back to the larger question that we had today, is that why is this being revived at this particular moment to do such a disservice to the work of this man to highlight and support such bad politics?
Yeah, I mean, if I were generous, I would say maybe there's something dangerous in this stuff, not in a kind of romantic sense, but in the sense that it gives the lie to the assumptions that we are, you know, laboring under, the neoliberal assumptions about how identity functions versus, say, class. They have to, I'm almost tempted to say colonize, but you get the point, right? Mm-hmm. You have to kind of find these folks, whether it's MLK or Rustin or Fanon or Shirley Chisholm or, you know, whatever it is that they're doing now, and tweak it to, and really, so yeah, we were talking to some friends about American Fiction, about even that. So that's like the novel's what, 10 years old, 20 years old, how the script alters it. So this is a kind of presentism, like presentism of right now. Mm-hmm. So it's like tweaking that even to make it say what we want it to say now. And as if the original is just like, you know, it's this kind of material to be handled. It's a good question. Why it's the basic question of ideology, right? It's how does ideology function, that it kind of needs these things.
But to your point about American Fiction, which we did a show on, I don't know if you saw that, can you even read that book if you've seen the movie? because the book's going to be a real shock to your system, because white people don't play the pivotal role that they play in the movie. And a lot of these films that are coming out, and what I call the last gasp of the black PMC, is as they've kind of ran through their George Floyd money. All these movies have kind of a main thesis, which is white people bad. You know, once we get over white people, then we'll get there, wherever there is supposed to be in these films. A book like Erasure by Percival Everett, one of the best books on kind of just everyday black class life, and to take all of the class out of it with, you know, talented actors to a degree, but it served a to your point, it served a mighty function when it comes to rehabilitating people on a meta level, like Issa Rae, who does come from privilege, like the character that she plays, and gets to have something that the book character doesn't have. The book character is mentioned a couple of times in the first few chapters, and that's it.
Right.
And the name is different as well. The book is Wanda Mae Jenkins. Right. But she gets to have like a redemption arc, so we can understand where she's coming from when she writes this drivel that becomes a movie that, you know, in real life won an Oscar, which is precious.
Right.
And all the quotes that were getting put on by white people in that movie were actually said by black people in real life. So does this charade need to be protected to protect job security?
I mean, that's not part of it. yeah, I mean, there's more or less degrees of subtlety of ideology, right? And kind of pinning it down is, you know, sometimes hard, because they're, you know, they are subtle often. Mm-hmm. There's kind of like the really, really, really bad, obvious versions. And then there's a kind of slight tweaking of things to kind of inject it with your contemporary concerns. But as you're saying, right, there's an arc to all of it, and the arc is the same. Mm-hmm. And all of it is about displacing class onto something more primal, right? Which is, you know, some kind of identity that is the original sin, right? Some original sin argument. I mean, yeah, I mean, maybe we shouldn't be so, maybe this isn't such a difficult thing. Maybe it is about money and the money of, because how does it possibly serve their interests to say that they're the ones actually, that is the people creating this stuff, are the ones generating the inequalities? It could just be as simple as that the people generating all this you know content have to replay this story over and over and over again, because otherwise what the story is about them and what they're doing. I mean, this is like the humongous tragedy of something like Trump. I mean, there's multiple tragedies of Trump, but it's like that makes them seem like they're right. Because you've got a fucking racist, so then you can congratulate yourself endlessly on calling this out without any more examination. But you know, the principle of the whole thing is, I think, is a kind of laziness of analysis, a cheap, easy, you know, one step analysis that apparently sells.
Pascal?
What's really tragic to me about this is that for a very small window of time, there was a politics that was working against these purveyors of this crude identity politics that tried to work along class lines when Sanders was kind of new and fresh. And they were very effective in leveraging their narrative to crush that kind of brief moment of class politics. And what's saddening to me is that there was never an attempt to really realign the terms of engagement to put those people who were using those kind of arguments on their back And when it came to them really trying to put a death knell in that Sanders politics, they did so pretty effectively. Or it collapsed on its own terms. So the question I have is that, is that moment really gone for good? Or are there capacities for moments like this when we see intellectual attempts to take someone like Fanon, who is an important thinker, even in the contextual sense, and call out the kind of work that's being done in this biography?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the way I would think about it, and maybe thinking about it in Fanon's terms, so in those political writings, right, he says about seeking out tactical alliances with colonial powers, with opposed interests, right? So you can kind of, there's an account of compromise. So Sanders, there's a certain amount of compromise you got to do to play the game, right? Mm-hmm. And Fanon, and I think any great political thinker is aware that this is what you got to do to get it done. So, Lenin writes about this, of course, in Left-Wing Communism, an infantile disorder, right? Left-wing communism, that's the purity, the purity hawks. It has to be like absolutely pure. And Lenin's like, well, who the fuck cares? You can make tactical compromises. But then, Fanon finishes the sentence and says, these alliances cannot dent our doctrinal positions, right? So that's the Sanders question, right? Is if you make alliances, you play the game, you give some space to these other, issues, as long as it doesn't dent the doctrinal position. I thought Sanders is good in that term. But it's just him, ultimately. There was, it needs more background, it needs more context for it to work. I don't think being hard line about bringing people into the, into the table and all that stuff is the right thing to do, as long as you don't dent your doctrinal position. And I think Fanon was good in that way. So he can if there's all kinds of tribal, commitments and religious commitments and whatever, anarchist and Marxist and all these people, he knew that there was no way this thing was going to happen if you didn't let people get, some voice in this thing, just as long as you don't dent the doctrinal position, which has to do with class. And I think Fanon is good with that. And that's, again, what makes him Marxist and what's been edited out. So for us, thinking politically, it's just about not losing your, losing your head with this stuff, knowing that when you do, accede to all these interest groups, these particularisms, that the particularism doesn't become the whole, and that's the ruse and bullshit of intersectionality is that's the rule of particularism, right? That's completely eviscerating the doctrinal position. So, it's, and I'll say on a more positive note, I actually think that a doctrinal position, like a class one, is totally appealing. Spent some time in Oklahoma not too long ago, and it's like if you talk to people about healthcare, like universal healthcare, they're for it, right? They probably have to package it again in some kind of insane package to make it sound like it's right wing or whatever, nothing to do with anything socialist or communist or whatever. But people want, if the bot at the end of the day they get free healthcare, they're on board. So how do we do that? And I think healthcare is like a wedge issue. I think healthcare is exactly the kind of thing that is appealing on a fundamental level for lots of people across the spectrum. And then that's the kind of, the doctrine's there, right? Mm-hmm. So if you start doing that, then you start making inroads about education, housing, But I think healthcare, for instance, is the linchpin to a practical politics, right? A pragmatic realism, as Fanon calls it. That's how you can kind of get the foot in the door.
I want to ask you, do you think that the ultimate problem with people who try to use Fanon's thinking as a one-size-fits-all for the oppressed is that it denies nuance to subjects of oppression than normally given? For example, the whole notion that, you know, everyone is a colonized subject and so on and so forth, et cetera, et cetera. Right. In other words, that it denies the subject matter. I mean, for example, we talked about on this show about, like, you know, can you use, you know, colonized metaphors for the state of Israel in terms of, you know, settler colonialism and things of that nature? Some people would say yes, some people would say no. And, you know, why are people so wedded to these narratives in the first place? As if that weakens the ability to find an alternative way to describe the situation, that you have to use these specific terminologies in the first place as well. I'd like you to know if you can speak to that.
Yeah. That's a good question. I think Fanon thought about that a lot, but it's maybe still a misstep. So, like, you know, the Sartre, anti-Semite and Jew, and Fanon, you know, with black skin, white mask, and Wretch of the Earth, they all start with the premise that they're at war, right? So Sartre says the Jew of today is in full war. And that for Fanon, it's like you have to be in this war situation. Mm-hmm. So if that's the terms, then you've got this Manicheism, as he calls it, this good and evil colonizer, colonized, and they're in war. And that's, you know, again, a kind of Marxist point. You get total clarity of the situation. They're the fucking enemy, right? There's no, you don't need any intellectuals to parse it for you. So for Fanon, it's the clarity of the situation that's really fundamental. And that he thinks is what can, you know, motivate people, is you get a total clarity about how brutal they are and what they are, and all the various manifestations of colonization. But I don't think he meant that it could be used as a kind of catch-all. So I think he is sensitive to different situations. And above all, he really wanted to get beyond that. You know, so you and this is his huge failure. The huge failure of Wretch of the Earth, in my view, is it's predicated on a complete clarity and transparency on the side of the colonized. So the colonized can read the colonizer with total legibility. They understand every single thing that they're doing all the time. So that Fanon believed that once this revolution is over, then we can come out of it and things will be great and healthy and wonderful. So the first chapter is all about the clarity of this difference between the colonizer and the colonized. But then, chapters 2 and 3 and 4 and 5, it's about this PMC, what we call the PMC, coming in to really mess with their heads. So they've got this clarity. It's a peasant. It's not the proletariat. It's the peasant in North Africa. They've got clarity about their situation. And then the intellectual, this opportunist, this low-grade bourgeoisie comes in to kind of, like, you know, obscure the situation for them. And that, I think, is, if you can almost follow the writing of the book, it's like he's got this view of clarity, and it's like, oh my God, as I'm living it, right? He's writing this in 60, 61. He dies in December of 61, but he's writing it. You know, he meets Sartre for the first time in April of 61 in Rome. He's got, like, chapters with him, and he's talking to him, and he's rewriting. You can almost feel him saying, you know, this situation's far more complicated and might not work out the way I thought it would. So that's why you kind of have to take it as a practical, almost living document. So in that sense, to your question, no, I don't think he thought that you can kind of transport this to other situations easily. But I would say, on the other hand, that, you know, I think the Hamas-Israel thing, I think that's, there's good reason that people are using Fanon for that. I was, you know, as I was rereading, you know, Wretched for this conversation, there's this passage, and I was like, oh, you know, I was kind of like, oh my God. And he says, right, he's talking about the peasants being once and for all demystified, right, by this process of terror and counterterror. They see for themselves that any number of speeches on human equality cannot mask the absurdity whereby seven Frenchmen killed or wounded in an ambush at the Simcoe Pass, that's in May of 56, sparks indignation of civilized consciousness, whereas the sacking of the Gougar Douars and the Jera Jeshra and the massacre of the population behind the ambush count for nothing, right? Mm-hmm. So there's an ambush, you got seven French are dead during the colonial, you know, decolonizing war, and that the world's up in arms, this is impossible. We're in Philippeville where there's more of a massacre, you know, this is outrageous, but then they slaughter the Africans and no one gives a shit. So, you know, there's a rough similarity here that I get, and I wouldn't want to take Fanon away from them on that score. Mm-hmm. Again, it's a kind of rhetorical. It's a rhetorical force that that is there, and he is a brilliant, you know, writer. But it, you know, you kind of have to get this, then come back to the sobering part of his argument, hopefully, about what and what the sobering part of that argument would be to say, you know, it's like, well, you know, yeah, this is the situation, but of course, Hamas is not a secularizing force. And that and Fanon's committed to a kind of secular, you know. All I'm saying about that is it's not totally applicable, or maybe it's actually too close to the North African situation in a certain sense, that it doesn't fulfill for Fanon his requirements of basically a kind of enlightenment commitment to a secular world, a Marxist secular world, but. You know, there's a rough similarity that is seems, you know, impossible to ignore.
What say you, Pascal?
I mean, I think that he definitely sees the importance of his model being used as a template. I don't think Fanon would deny the differentiations that exist in those localities, but I think that Fanon, I mean, we cannot deny the fact that he was a Francophile dealing in the Muslim world. He was not alien to dealing with the Arab-speaking Muslim world. And I can see himself finding, sympathy with the Palestinians and wanting them to apply his theories to their plight.
No doubt.
No doubt, without any question whatsoever.
Oh, yeah. No doubt. No doubt. I mean, he does. There's a break with Sartre on this very question. I mean, it's kind of complicated. I mean, Sartre was in the 70 war. There's a break there. So Josie Fanon, his wife, asked to have the preface written by Sartre to Russia the Earth taken out of the next of the post 67 edition after the 70s war, because she thought that Sartre was too forgiving of the Israelis. I mean, that's actually a kind of complicated and interesting question. I think Sartre is a pretty nuanced thinker himself, but I can see what she's saying as well. There's no question that Fanon would what side he'd be on. None.
Do you think Sartre is too forgiving to Israelis? Do you think he's pro-Zionist to a certain extent, or do you think he's more pro? A state for them.
Yeah, I wouldn't say he's Zionist. I don't think I'm not competent enough on that kind of later Sartre to say. I don't know enough about his position on Israel. He's a brilliant and eloquent writer about anti-Semitism, obviously. Mm-hmm. And what's interesting, of course, is that was taken up most fundamentally by Fanon talking about, you know, anti-Black racism. Mm-hmm. Rightly so. I think there's no Fanon without Sartre. It's just he took a massive amount from Sartre and anti-Semite and Jew. I mean, the basic principle of anti-Semitic Jew is that, you know, right, Sartre ends the book by quoting Richard Wright. He says, there's no Negro problem in the United States. There's only a white problem. And that is to say, it's the colonists' problem. That we didn't make this shit. It's you. You made us into this. So if you're seeing violence, that's on you. You taught us violence, and we're using it back. So, you know, the premise of anti-Semite and Jew is the same premise as black skin, white masks, is that, right, as Sartre puts it, he says, the Jew is the one to whom other men consider a Jew, right? The anti-Semite makes the Jew. So the racist makes race, right? And that's a premise I think, you know, Fanon takes up fully, and I think is you know, totally right. That this is a problem created by the racists and the exploiters. It's not on the victims. I mean, again, Sartre is as complicated. I would just want to say Sartre is as complicated a figure as Fanon, and Sartre gets kind of a bad rap in a sense. I mean, the preface is not his best. And so many people have said, probably rightly, that Sartre's kind of responsible for the really romanticizing of the violence.
Really?
Talk about, like, as Pascal was saying, like, you know, Sartre's relationship to North Africa is, you know, really tangential. So it's a kind of, you know, love affair from a distance, right? A kind of, you know, Orientalism almost. That's too harsh on him. Where, you know, Fanon, you know, he was there in the trenches. I mean, he was an outsider, but serious. I don't think anyone would say otherwise, that, you know, he was seriously committed to the cause, mainly through writing. You know, he was a rhetorician. If people are interested, the Adam Schatz biography is good about the kind of complexities of on the ground situation and his relationships with FLN, ALN, you know, the freedom fighters, and the changing sides and the kind of, you know, mess that it was.
Can you say more about Fanon's relationship with the white left and the white Marxists, the communists, and why many on the black left use that to question his adherence to communism or Marxism?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is a hot button.
Yeah, this is the dun 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 question. Yeah,
this is the hot button in Fanon studies or whatever. What all of these stories and biographies want to say about Fanon is that there's some enlightenment moment, some aha moment where he gets the fucking word on high about racism, and that's the end of the story for him. So that no matter what, no matter how much, you know, Marxism he takes in, proletariat, white, you know, stuff he takes in, he's fundamentally shaped by these moments of racial encounter. And so different authors have different moments. If you're Adam Schatz, it's a boy on a train in Lyon. So Fanon's in Lyon, and he's, you know, studying philosophy with Merleau-Ponty and all this stuff. And some kid on the train uses some racial epithet, and that's it. So he knows now that this is how things are. So that the Marxists are always, you know, they're ultimately push comes to shove, they're going to go for their white commitments, right? And there's not, it's not being naive. It's not totally wrong. The Communist Party, his relationship to the Algerian Revolution was
weak, to say the least.
It was, and especially at crucial moments. And that was terribly, you know, that was a horrible moment for them. There's no question that the communists let them down at crucial moments. And Fanon makes his point that, look, he says Marxism needs to be stretched, disentendu. It needs to be, you know, And he says that in Wretched, and he, by that he means something pretty specific. It needs to be about the peasant, right? It ain't the proletariat, it ain't the urban centers, it's the interior, right? So there's lots of kind of debates about the exterior and the interior in Algeria. And he, you know, said ultimately, I mean, he kind of changed his mind on this stuff, but he said it's the interior, it's the peasantry, they're the ones that hold the future in their hands and all that stuff. And there's no doubt there's a certain level of romance of it, and it's a certain amount of fuck you to the Communist Party in France, and deserve it. So, you know, but I don't think it would be right to say that there is a kind of, like, he ditches it or something like that, or he gets the word on high that it's really about race in the end. That's unsustainable, as far as I can tell, in what Fanon says. Even if there's all, it's like, look, you know, were unions in the 60s and 70s racist? Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. 50s. Yeah, of course. Mm-hmm. But, you know, is that what determines their essence? You know, this is what they're talking about. It's compromises, as long as you don't lose the doctrine. So, you know, it's not a purity test. And making it, this is maybe the issue, right, is that they're trying to make it into a kind of purity test. You either know that racism is the core of all things, it's the original sin, you know, from the beginning of time or whatever, or you're just on the other side, and it doesn't matter if you're a fucking capitalist or a communist, you're all on the other side. And that's just not how they thought. They thought that the Communist Party, the party, was deeply flawed. But I don't think for a second Fanon, you know, questioned communism as the basic model for how this stuff works. I'm willing to kind of go head to head with anyone on this question, but it involves the kind of nitty gritty of what it is he's saying, as well as the kind of more basic ways in which he's edited, you know, edited the books that people think are like the kind of purely philosophical ones, like Black Skin, White Mask, which people think is a deep, not certainly not communist. Of course, the conclusion ends with a big paragraph from Marx and the 18th Brumaire. And this is like, and there's a great moment, if I can find it, it's really hilarious almost. So he says, he said, this is the conclusion to Black Skin, White Mask. He says, it is obvious, and I can't stop repeating it, that the motivations for disalienating a physician from Guadalupe are essentially different from those for the African construction worker in the port of Abidjan, right, in Ivory Coast, right? And he says this over and over. It's like, that's the PMC point, right? The doctor ain't on the same fucking team as the worker. Right. And if you think they're on the same team, you're deluded. And that's the class argument. So the worker, and he can't stop repeating it, the physician and the worker are not on the same team. And that's not a race question. Right. That's a question. That's a class position. And that's, you know, coming out of his account of the 18th Brumaire. And he opens the book by saying, first, this is a sentence in the first pages of the book. It says he calls the true disalienation of the Black man, one must have a brutal awareness of the social and economic realities that underlie the category of race. He says it's a double process. First, economic, then internalization of inferiority. He says this over and over again, right? First, economic, that race functions as a way to divide the masses against one another and exploit them, right? So it's the first is the economic, then the inferiority. You feel inferior, therefore you can accept your exploitation. That's the logic of colonialism and of capitalism. And colonialism is a variant within capitalism. It's, you know, capitalism requires colonialism. Colonialism requires racism.
Pascal, you look like you want to say something.
No, I think that one of the things that's to me that has always been very interesting about Fanon and his willingness to demonstrate how much he is interested in using class as a barometer and hierarchy of the mechanisms in which material oppression exists is his unwillingness to support cultural nationalism. Like, when he talks about Richard Wright, he talks about, like, you know, he also talks about Negritude and all of these movements. He's like, come on, this is bullshit. He's like, this stuff is soft as hell. I mean, it's like, you know, poems? What is with your poem?
Where's your poems? Where's your degrees?
I love it. You're totally right. That, I mean, another fact that's repressed. It's another fact that's just fucking edited out. It's exactly right. I mean, the cultural nationalism, he has absolutely no time for it, right? And he thinks that's part of this kind of, you know, managerial class, which is a phrase he uses, their attitude, right? They're going to come in with their cultural objects. I mean, I'm an art historian, so I should probably shut up. But, you know, he thinks that's just total nonsense. So he likes Wright, you know, in Black Skin, White Mask. He's kind of a fan, so is Sartre. But then, you know, certainly by the 50s, he goes hard against them, against Negritude. I mean, he's indebted to his teacher, Cesar. But yeah, he thinks that the cultural nationalism is a total dead end. It's this whole kind of, you know, many-headed beast of this kind of managerial class intellectuals that has to, you know, you have to attack on multiple fronts. Which maybe brings us back to what we started with, right? It's like the many-headed beast of this kind of cultural politics.
Oh, we saw a lot of play out in the United States in the late 60s, early 70s with, you know, the Black Arts Movement and all of these other manifestations that come out of Black power that just really to stop dealing with any kind of real politics. And this ends up becoming just kind of this, you know, the expression of, you know, racial authenticity with the Shakespearean authenticity, racial vindicationism. Dan Street, man.
Quoting Fanon.
Yep.
Well, his name is Todd Cronin. Todd, where can people find you or your works?
I guess at Nonsite, nonsite.org, the journal.
And that's it? There's nothing you're plugging?
No, not. No. I'm writing for a magazine, and that'll come out in a few weeks, a few months maybe.
But you wrote a book.
Yeah, I've written a few books. I wrote a book on, you know, I wrote a book on Matisse. I wrote a book on called Red Aesthetics, which is on Brecht and Eisenstein, and then a book on architecture in California. Yeah. So
are you a native Californian?
Yeah.
Where are you from?
LA.
Of course you are.
is that bad or good? Oh man.
I am from the Bay Area, Todd. And I live here in Mexico, and I've had an ass full of Dodger hats.
Got it.
I'm a not Giants a fan.
I'm a
you're not a Dodgers fan?
No.
Are you an Angels fan?
No, I'm not a baseball guy. I'm a Laker fan. NBA purist.
are you a Laker fan?
I'm more of a Clippers fan.
No one's a Clippers fan.
Oh no, see, I'm a
Sixers. It's you and Billy Crystal.
So I'm a Sixers fan because that's Sixers is my team.
Okay.
But Clippers are like, you know, it's kind of like sub Sixers team now.
You grew up with Dr. J.
Yeah.
Okay. That's fair. I'm 46, so most people my age, even if you're from the Bay Area, you're probably a Lakers fan.
Yeah, I mean, I was in the 80s. And it was everywhere. I mean, don't get me wrong. I was into the Lakers in the 80s for sure.
Yeah, I thought where the Warriors played when I was a kid is just where the Ice Capades were. I didn't know that was where our basketball team played. We didn't know the Warriors were there.
Yeah, we saw the Warriors smoke the Sixers a few weeks ago. It was not fun.
Good. Hope Curry went off.
No, he only had 9 points actually.
That's what you get for being from LA.
Fair enough.
Very much enjoyed this conversation, man. We'd love to have you on again.
Anytime, guys. Anytime.
Pascal, you ready to go to the champagne room?
I'm ready for some champagne.
Todd, are you going to be joining us in the champagne room?
Sure.
All right. It's going to be a good time. I believe I sent you the link, didn't I?
I don't know, actually.
I will email you shortly.
Yeah, totally.
Thank you guys so much for hanging out with us. We will be going into the champagne room. Maybe I'll open up the phones. I'm sure people will have some things to say about the show tonight. That'll be fun. Cool. If you want to join us in the Champagne Room, there's one way. It's very easy. Patreon.com/Bitter Lake Presents. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, just sign up on Apple and you have access to the Champagne Room as well. And on that note, we are
out.